The British populist of science, Richard Dawkins, has claimed that God is delusion. To be more accurate in making his point, he should have put it that belief in God is delusional. Tony Blair, like him or not, is openly a believer. But he realised that his faith was expressed in a very hostile environment in Britain. It's difficult if you talk about religious faith in our political system. If you're in the American political system or others, then you can talk about religious faith and people say, yes, that's fair enough. And it's something they respond to quite naturally. You talk about it in our system, and frankly, people do think you're a nutter. That's a quote. Believers throughout almost every other sphere in society could echo this exasperated comment on what is acceptable in British political and public life. Mention God and you're a nutter. Faith is delusion. These epithets show current interest. How in an era when science, technology and market forces appear to explain all of human choice and variation, can people still believe in God, spirit, other? To claim that such people are simply primitive and ill-educated, as some have, is not convincing. After all, there are many graduates, a substantial number in science and medicine amongst believers. An alternative explanation is to say that such people must be mad, or at least severely neurotically disturbed. Spiritual matters, concern about meaning and existence, are very important for many of our patients suffering from mental illness. But doctors, and especially psychiatrists, have often completely overlooked this. More importantly, for suffering patients, many doctors have, without examining the evidence, assumed that religious belief is bad for your health and discouraged patients from practicing their religion. Jean Davison, the author of this book, was a Christian teenager in Bradford in Yorkshire, near where I worked. She was treated as an inpatient in a mental hospital in the 1970s. She describes how psychiatrists repeatedly disparaged her faith until, sadly, she abandoned it. If they wanted me to relinquish all thoughts of God, why didn't they try to help me see that life could be bearable, even happy, without a God to believe in? Instead, they kept on subjecting me to treatment, which made me cry out in desperation to this remote, perhaps fictitious God to help me. More than ever before, I wanted and needed him now. When Jean was first admitted to hospital, her doctor said to her, "Hell doesn't exist. The Bible isn't meant to be taken literally. It's full of metaphors. Heaven doesn't exist either. The world's moved on from fairy tales to science." The doctor sighed. "But really, love, you ought to have had more sense than to try and believe things like that in the first place, don't you think?" I am ashamed that someone from the profession to which I've been committed for 50 years could have been so crass and insensitive. It did poor Jean enormous long-term harm. Why did they do this? Well, it's a long story, and it's all in the book, but to cut it short, by the mid-20th century, the attitude of many psychiatrists towards the beliefs of their patients and organized religion in general was hostile. The churches had a deep distrust of psychiatry, regarding it as at best useless and at worst promoting atheism and amorality. Over more recent years, there has been some degree of reconciliation between these opposing positions. John Swinton, a theologian and previously a psychiatric nurse, has shown us that mental health professionals need to speak and think in the language of spirituality, focusing on meaning, hope, value, connectedness, and transcendence, as well as the language of psychiatry and psychology. Is faith delusion is not a simple question of fact. It carries implications, animosity, and its own history. Patients want more emphasis on the spiritual aspect of their psychiatric care, and they want mental health professionals to take their beliefs into account in planning services. It is people like me, we psychiatrists and other mental health professionals, who have lagged behind. Over the next few minutes, I will try to answer, or at least deal with, the following questions. Why has there been hostility between religious faith and psychiatry? Is there necessarily a difference of opinion between scientific psychiatry and Christian faith? Is Christian faith harmful towards mental health? What is delusion? Why can faith not be a delusion? Could faith be a psychiatric symptom other than delusion? And is it a psychiatric illness or a religious experience? A practical question that many people have asked. Why has there been hostility between religious faith and psychiatry? The earliest reference to the mind and to mental illness in the Hebrew scriptures, the Homeric epics and Pharaonic writings, make no distinction between religious and mental notions. There was no conflict because there was no psychiatry. Benevolent care for mentally ill people started in this country in the religious houses in the Middle Ages, alongside looking after lepers and others with chronic physical illness. Mental illness, as a concept, was a Renaissance idea, and sufferers were shown understanding and compassion. Some, however, in the church blamed demons for madness, but those with a more rational approach considered it to be illness of the mind. This polarization greatly increased during the witch hunts of the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries, when some mentally ill people were identified as witches and burnt. This resulted in a major rift between medical and spiritual theories for the origin of psychiatric disorders. When psychiatry became a distinct medical discipline round about 1800, developments in this specialty resulted in medical reductionism. In Germany, Wilhelm Griesinger in 1867, sometimes regarded as the first biological psychiatrist, stated that progress had occurred because patients with so-called mental illnesses are really individuals with illnesses of the nerves and brain. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? All altered mental states and resultant behavior were considered to be based on disturbance of brain function. During the 19th century, moral treatment was developed, especially at the retreat in York, and especially in this country. The principles were paying attention to the well-being of the patient, providing optimal social conditions within the hospital, and bolstering the self-respect and esteem of the patient. They encouraged the patients to keep pet rabbits on the ward, which was a very civilized thing to do. I don't think it would go down very well now, but it was progress, in fact. This had significant beneficial effects on care for patients. Treating them with dignity produced improvements in their mental state, and this was based on Christian, largely Quaker, principles. On the other hand, the theory of degeneration, which arose out of Darwinian natural selection, had virtually halted efforts to treat people in psychiatric practice by the end of the 19th century. Any of you are interested, I recommend Sebastian Falk's novel about the history of psychiatry, and the name of it will come back to me later. In the first half of the 20th century, psychiatry became ever more rationalist and reductionist. By the middle of the century, there was a huge gulf with mutual suspicion between the church and the psychiatric establishment. Psychiatrists considered that religion was at best irrelevant for their patients, and that sometimes it was harmful to their mental health, preventing them from receiving proper treatment. Religious people regarded psychiatry as atheistic, amoral, and therapeutically ineffective. Both sides were partially correct, and occasionally there was open hostility between them. The second half of the 20th century saw a very gradual resolution. The attitude within psychiatry towards spirituality and religion has changed, I'm glad to say, with much more public discussion and acceptance. Psychiatrists became more prepared to acknowledge the importance of their patients' beliefs. Most churches were more prepared to use psychiatry for their members. There are organisations among psychiatrists trying to reconcile the spiritual aspects with psychiatry. Is there a difference of opinion between scientific psychiatry and Christian faith? Well, science obviously has increased our ability to treat patients. For example, bipolar disorder can usually be managed adequately nowadays. There's no conflict between science and faith when the boundaries of their separate realms are maintained. However, when science becomes scientism and a way of life, there's a tendency to regard everything else not amenable to scientific inquiry as irrelevant. Religious belief in healthy people cannot be explained by science, and so belief is considered irrational and hence delusional. Christian doctors and patients alike welcome the application of advances in the neurosciences to psychiatric treatment, although I have to say there is very little advance that has actually come from neuroscientific research. Most of the advances were purely accidental. But when science has become dogma, it has ceased to be a tool for research and become a philosophy or even a religion. Because we can locate an experience or behavior in the brain, it does not mean that the idea is meaningless or non-existent. I see my beautiful cherry tree each year in May with my occipital cortex. the back part of my brain, that I can locate where the visual sensation is registered does not mean that the experience itself is meaningless, nor that the cherry tree does not exist. It's obvious. But when you extend that to religious feelings and belief, the neuroscientists have sometimes got things very wrong. No. Scientific psychiatry and Christian faith are not necessarily opposed to each other at all. In fact, together they can make an important contribution to the well-being of people whom they are both trying to help. When the establishment of science and religion have pontificated outside their area of influence, there has been acrimony. This has been harmful to mentally ill patients trapped in the middle. Is Christian faith harmful towards mental health? And there have been many, both in the philosophy of science and also in medicine, who have believed it was. In the last few years, there's been an enormous amount of research on the outcome for those with religious commitment with various mental illnesses. The evidence linking health with religious belief and practice is gathered in the second edition of the Handbook of Religion and Health, published last year by Koenig, King and Carson. You need very big hands for this book. It's the size of a small newborn infant. It reviews more than 3,000 quantitative database studies exploring the relationship between religion or spirituality and mental and physical health conditions. Overwhelmingly, most studies find a positive relationship between religion, spirituality, and good mental and physical health. And those studies that are longitudinal studies, i.e. over time, show a greater finding than those that are cross-sectional, just looking at the association at this moment in time. That is, to my way of thinking, strong evidence. The authors looked at various aspects of social and mental health and found that in the great majority of studies, religious involvement is correlated positively with the following qualities. I wish I could go through this in detail and explain it all, but I can't. There's just too much that I want to say, so I just have to give you the raw facts. So it's correlated with well-being, happiness, and life satisfaction, and they've used scales for all of these. Hope and optimism, purpose and meaning in life, higher self-esteem, better adaptation to bereavement, greater social support and less loneliness, lower rates of depression and faster recovery from depression, lower rates of suicide and fewer positive attitudes towards suicide, less anxiety, less psychosis and fewer psychotic tendencies, lower rates of alcohol and drug abuse, less delinquency and criminal activity, greater marital stability and satisfaction. And all those factors have been associated with greater mental health. The actual statistics vary from different factor to different factor, but all of them have been found to a significant extent to be correlated with religious belief and practice. There are direct benefits of belief and practice, such as being more optimistic and coping better in response to stressful circumstances. There are also indirect effects, including lifestyle and social support, the support of the community of the church. Of the many studies linking religious belief and practice with depressive illness, 65% reported significant benefits from religious involvement. Findings for depression can be summarized. Those with Christian belief and practice have a lower risk for developing depressive disorder and symptoms, and religious activity may lead to a reduction in depressive symptoms. In particular, involvement in religious community activities and valuing faith highly convey advantage, and organisational, that is, such things as going to church, rather than private activities, give the most benefit. Religious involvement helps people to cope with stressful life events, which are often precursors to depressive illness. Religious belief is also a powerful protective factor from suicide and suicidal behaviour in children, adolescents, and adults. There are benefits from religious belief and practice for other mental illness as well. The advantage of religious belief and spirituality for mental and physical health is one of the best kept secrets in psychiatry and in medicine generally. If the findings of a huge volume of research on this topic had gone in the opposite direction, and it had been found that religion does in fact damage your health, it would have been front page news in every newspaper in the land. All the information I've given you and all the studies are of course based on epidemiology, and I'd be very happy to talk more about that because much of my own research has been in that field. We are talking about conditions in large populations. All of us can give examples of a Christian who was made more anxious by going to church, or sadly, a Christian who did in fact kill himself. Individual cases can be found in the other direction, but overall, the epidemiology shows a massive benefit for what the authors have called religious belief and practice, or more recently, they call it RS, which I think is a horrible acronym, religion, spirituality. What is delusion? Now, I'm afraid some of you may want to have a snooze at this stage, because I am going to get a little technical. Delusion is now a psychiatric word. It belongs to psychiatry in a sense, and it's the task of the psychiatrist to say what is and is not delusion. In law, for instance, delusion is the cardinal feature of insanity. Therefore, if faith is delusional, the believer is insane to believe it. We explore what a delusion is by studying the subjective experience of those who suffer. That is, getting people to say what actually they are thinking and feeling inside. How can you study my subjective experience? You can't. Well, you can, in fact. The psychiatrist tries to get beneath the words the patient uses to reach what they mean for this person using understanding and empathy. Now, understanding in this sense, described by Carl Jaspers, involves the use of empathy. That is, subjective evaluation of the patient experience by the understander, him or herself, using his or her own qualities of observation and of feeling as a human being, both cognitive and emotional, feeling inside the other person in a cognitive and emotional sense. And it sounds complicated, and it is complicated. It takes many years to learn it, it is a very difficult task. The distinction between form and content is particularly important as well. In this sense, form indicates the type of abnormality of mental experience, such as false belief or depressed mood, whilst content reflects the predominant concerns of the patient arising from their own cultural and individual standpoint. This old lady, who has always been preoccupied with money and bankruptcy, may believe, erroneously, that the nurses are stealing her money. The content comes from her background interests and her world. The form is that she has a false belief. Delusions are held without insight. I do not know that I am deluded. Those deluded commonly show concrete thinking, converting the abstract or metaphorical into physical or literal. A religious belief cannot be a group or shared experience. It can't be a shared delusion. Communicated delusion is quite different in nature and very rarely shows a religious content. Delusions cannot be shared because they're ultimately ununderstandable to another person. One is unable to understand why another person could hold this particular belief with this degree of intensity. Although John Smith and William Brown both believe on the psychiatric ward that they are Jesus Christ, John Smith does not believe that William Brown is, and vice versa, and it cannot be a shared belief. Delusion is a false, unshakable idea or belief which is out of keeping with the patient's educational, cultural, and social background. It's held with extraordinary conviction and subjective certainty. It's experienced as an everyday notion rather than a creedal statement, and is believed also on delusional grounds. Why can faith not be delusional? Well, people with religious faith often hold beliefs that other people find unacceptable or false. This does not make them delusional or mad. Even for very bizarre and socially unacceptable religious sects, for instance, there are reasons why the beliefs are not delusions. And I'm now going to give you these reasons. They're not out of keeping with that individual's cultural and social background. Other members of the church or the cult share these extraordinary beliefs. They're not necessarily held on delusional grounds. If you ask, why do you believe that? The likely answer to be given is that, well, those are the doctrines of their group, not that he heard them spoken out loud by a pink salamander. So there is a difference. They are a very significant difference. Religious beliefs are spiritual, abstract, and not concrete, physical. When a Christian says that Jesus Christ is inside me, he's describing a spiritual event. it would be unthinkable to try and ask him and for him to determine which bodily organ he was within. And yet the concrete thinker would say the latter. Religious beliefs are held with insight. The believer can understand others not believing. And he or she may have some doubts, particularly about the details of his religious belief. Doesn't need me to give you examples of that, but I'm sure you can think about them. For religious people without mental illness, bizarre thoughts and actions do not occur in other areas of life not connected with religion. They can give a clear and uncomplicated account of how to walk to the post office or of their mother-in-law's recent illness. And I used to have a lot of junior psychiatrists working with me who didn't share my religious beliefs. And they were totally at sea when they were asked to see Christians who had been asked to decide whether they were suffering from a mental illness or not. And I always used to suggest to them, well, lead the discussion away from talking about religion onto other areas and see whether there are still symptoms present. Religious ideation and predominant thinking is a description of content. Remember the lady I talked about who was interested in money? Well, some of us are interested in religion, and it's part of our background thinking. And it doesn't affect the form of our thinking. Delusion is a disorder of form, and so this is irrespective of the content. Of course, a person with religious beliefs may also develop a mental illness. They're both, after all, common states of humanity. And suffering delusions may be a part of that illness that they've developed independently. The two, belief and illness, may occur together, but when they do, the religious belief as such has not caused the illness, neither is religiosity solely an expression of a disordered mind. Could faith be another sort of psychiatric symptom other than delusion? Psychiatric symptom, what people experience and suffer, follow certain patterns. They're not arbitrary. It's infuriating reading novelists' work sometimes, and they describe somebody who they regard as mad, and you know, I say this has got nothing to do with mental illness whatsoever. Illnesses follow patterns in the same way as physical illnesses follow patterns. Faith cannot just be an expression of delusion. So are there other psychiatric symptoms that could account for religious belief? Overvalued idea is a reasonable idea, but pursued beyond the bounds of reason. Is religion just taking an idea to excess, like thinking one's nose is so utterly ugly that the only solution is to take one's life? No, many believers do not hold their faith in that sort of way at all. They don't have that degree of emotional involvement. In the opinion of militant atheists, the idea itself, the belief, is not reasonable or comprehensible. Shared fundamental beliefs do not usually have the quality of overvalued idea. Culturally shared beliefs can be bizarre and irrational in nature, like the belief shared by most of the trainee nurses in this psychiatric unit in Zambia, that you can catch mental illness from the patients. There's no necessary connection with religion in this. So a culturally shared belief doesn't necessarily have anything to do with religion at all. Paranoid ideas of self-reference, believing oneself to be persecuted, are not infrequent, especially in those who are actually subject to persecution, or in this case, persecuting others, which may be religious in nature. There's no causal relationship, however, between the two. Abnormal mood states may occur in which the content is religious. This does not mean that the mood state was caused by religion. And this man, William Cooper, is a great favourite of mine, and I've quoted him at length and read him at length on many occasions. He's a man who developed depressive illness, mostly depressive, but he did have one or two manic swings. And throughout his life, he suffered from this recurrent condition, it prevented him from being able to believe in the first place, but when he got better, then he was able to believe in faith and take on faith, and it was with him on and off throughout his life. Again, I'd love to talk about him more, but I can't. Abnormal mood states may occur with religious belief, but it doesn't mean that the mood state was caused by religion. Hearing the voice of God is not necessarily auditory hallucination, nor a pathological experience. The Old Testament prophets, like Samuel here, and many people, and St. Paul, and many people today, speak of hearing the voice of God. Are all these people describing an auditory hallucination? That is, a perception without an object? No, this voice is not experienced as something outside self, nor as a sensation that another person might hear. Quite often, it has an as-if quality to it. The subject describes it as spiritual, abstract, demanding action, and not concrete or physical. There were 40 members of an English Pentecostal church completed a questionnaire on prayer, and 25 of these described hearing the voice of God. Simon Dean, a friend of mine, the author of this paper, concluded that this experience was not necessarily evidence of any psychopathology, and many of his subjects reported the voice to be helpful in situations of doubt or difficulty. So we're not talking about mental illness in this area at all. This has always fascinated me. The expression in Christ, with Christ, Christ in me, all of them expressions that I myself would want to use about myself. These are often used by Christians. They're spiritual rather than concrete in form. They are not explained by a psychotic passivity experience, Christ coming inside me in a literal way, or a dissociative trance, as in possession disorder. Belief in the indwelling of God is neither delusional nor evidence of any other psychiatric symptom. Those who do not believe in God may not realize what the experience of God to the believer can mean or is like. Any or all of these symptoms may occur in an individual with religious belief, but they're not specific to believers, and the symptom is not the cause of belief, nor its consequence. The two are not essentially related. Is it psychiatric illness? or religious experience? You'll be glad to know that this is the last question. Psychiatric illness, as opposed to what is not illness, but religious experience, psychiatric illness is suggested by the following. The person's description of their inner state and observed behaviour conform with known psychiatric symptoms. They're recognised as being psychiatric illness. For instance, it has the form of delusion. An inpatient believed with complete certainty that everyone coming onto her ward in the hospital nodded in her direction because they knew, in her words, that she was a secret emissary of the Holy Spirit. Now, I have no doubt that everyone coming onto her ward when she looked up at them did nod in her direction. Equally, I have no doubt that it wasn't because they knew with absolute certainty, without her saying, that she was an emissary of the Holy Spirit. There are recognisable symptoms of mental illness in areas of life other than religion. These may include delusions, hallucinations, disturbance of mood or thought disorder. A person with religious delusions also believed that gas was being pumped through her locked front door and making her sporadically unconscious. So it's in other areas as well as religion. The lifestyle, behaviour and direction of personal goals of the individual after the religious experience are consistent with the natural history of a mental disorder rather than with a personally enriching life experience. I once visited an unhappy young man living on his own without any occupation in a filthy, chaotic one-room flat. His only friends and contacts were in the local Roman Catholic Church. His lifestyle demonstrated psychiatric disorder irrespective of his beliefs, and from what he said, one could make a clear diagnosis of schizophrenia being present. Finally, the thoughts and actions of a person with schizophrenia are often concrete, physical, and not abstract or spiritual. Beliefs may be acted on literally. If he describes Christ being in me, for instance, he might well state in which organ of his body Christ could be located. A person without mental illness, but with religious conviction, shows quite different behaviour. The following indicates the person's belief and are unlikely to signify psychiatric illness. Religious experiences are usually regarded by the believer as being metaphorical or spiritual, whilst with mental illness, the experience may be concrete or physical. For the religious person, the physical boundaries of self are not invaded. In fact, the paradox is the Christian describes when Christ lives in him, the paradox is that he is a freer person, more independent of external influences. And there's been a lot of work done on the concept of locus of control. And to summarise, Christians are predominantly found to have an internal locus of control, that is, they are more in control of their circumstances. An internal locus of control is associated with a greater degree of life satisfaction. The person shows thoughtful reticence in discussing his or her experience, especially with those he anticipates will be unsympathetic. The believer describing a religious experience will choose carefully to whom he or she talks, the situation in which the conversation takes place, for example, perhaps just the two of them, and the words and phrases used are chosen carefully to describe the experience, bearing in mind that the other person maybe I'm convinced. This again is unlike mental illness. It's described unemotionally with matter-of-fact conviction and appears authentic. There's often a degree of surprise that he or she has had such an experience. The person understands, allows for, and even sympathizes with the other's incredulity.